The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi Mordechai Dinnerman now presents his lecture, The Cairo Geniza, Decoding the Life and Times of Maimonides.
On the screen, you're able to see an image of the Ben Ezra Synagogue in Cairo. This is an image of the interior of the synagogue, how it appears today. This synagogue is a very ancient synagogue, and while it has been destroyed and rebuilt numerous times, as an institution, it has existed for more than 1,000 years. And this is the famous synagogue that housed the Cairo Geniza. What do we mean by that? In this image, if you're able to tell, there's the women's gallery on the right-hand side and on the left-hand side. If you were to go up to the women's gallery, not on the right side, but on the left side, and walk all the way to what is the northern wall, which is facing Jerusalem, you would, and looked high up on the wall, you would see an alcove or a gap in the wall, which is where many documents were stored over the course of many centuries. Here is a diorama of what this would have looked like while it was in use. Today, this is this diorama is in the Museum of the Jewish People in Tel Aviv. And the idea of the Geniza is a very simple idea. What's unique about the Cairo Geniza, I'll explain in a second. We sacred text should not be discarded. And as a result, for as long as anyone can remember, these documents are often, and manuscripts are brought to the synagogue, where they eventually are taken out and buried in a cemetery. For reasons that no one could really explain, the second part of this process never happened in Cairo, which means the manuscripts or the old chumashim or the old books were being brought to this Geniza, but for whatever reason, they were never being taken out, and no one really understands why. Another unique and important thing to realize here is that these were not only sacred texts. Many mundane documents were stored away here as well. Also, not entirely clear why. It is important to note that in Arabic writing and Judeo-Arabic writing as well, it was very common to refer to God in the beginning of a note. And that may be one of the reasons why they felt that such documents were sacred, which is why they're there. And as a result of that, scholars today are able to learn so much about so many different areas of Jewish life that from the Middle Ages. There are documents going back to the 9th and 10th centuries, quite old. And this was used for almost 1,000 years, where continuously documents are being uploaded, so to speak, to use computer language, into this Geniza and never being taken out. The discovery of the Cairo Geniza itself is a fascinating story. It happens around the year 1890. We're not going to be too concerned with that story today. The result is that all these documents are eventually removed, and today they are spread out at different libraries around the world. What's most interesting for our purposes here today, and really the Cairo Geniza, people from any field can find something for them here. If you're interested in the social life of the Jews at the time, you have material there. If you're interested in rabbinics, there are so many old rabbinic texts, some of which have been completely forgotten and only have been rediscovered because of this particular Geniza. Unique for our purposes today is Maimonides. And that's because Maimonides lived very close to this particular synagogue. And when scholars throughout the course of the 20th century were going through the documents, they came across a document that you see here on the screen. This is written in Judeo-Arabic. This was the Jewish version of Arabic that Jews would be using at the time. And what's unique about it is that at the final line, and I'll make it a little bigger right now so you can see it, you can probably make out the words Ben Reb Maimon, and the word before that is Moshe. Moshe Ben Reb Maimon, and then the final word is Zayin Kuf Lamed Zecher Kadosh Levracha, which is what one would write after one has passed away. This is none other than Maimonides' autograph, his signature. And the reason that's important is because when we look at this, we're able to see, in fact, the entire letter is written in his own handwriting. And now we're looking with our eyes at an actual autograph copy of Maimonides. I want to take a moment to discuss how unique that is. We have many great sages in our history. So, for example, Rashi is one of the greatest biblical commentators and wrote the commentary on the Talmud. If I asked you, did you ever see Rashi's handwriting? The answer would have to be no. Did you ever see Rabbeinu Tam's handwriting? The answer would have to be no. Go up and down the list of medieval Jewish rabbis, ask, did you ever see their handwriting? And the answer almost always would have to be no. To be sure, we have their Torah, we have their content, and that's because copyists would copy their ideas, and thereby they were transmitted to us to this day. And that's how we're able to study the works of many of our predecessors. But the idea of having the actual handwriting of Maimonides, and in this case his handwriting and his signature, is highly unique. Of course, given the stature of Maimonides and how great he was, it makes so much sense that he would be an outlier in this way as well. Once we have this, we have a master document that we're able to, so to speak, look at other texts that may not have Maimonides' signature, but if the handwriting matches up, then suddenly we know that we are looking at Maimonides' handwriting. And in fact, this is not just one document. There are dozens and dozens of documents that have been discovered during the course of the 20th century that are written by Maimonides' hand. I'm going to come back to this a little later, but Maimonides had great-grandchildren who left Egypt, and they moved up north, and they moved to Syria, and they settled in Aleppo. And you could imagine a scenario where they're leaving town. The airlines have rules on how much baggage you could bring onto the horse and buggy, and there is a difficult decision they need to make about what are they bringing with them and what are they leaving. And it does seem that there was some sort of archive that belonged to Maimonides that stayed within the family and that at a certain point was dumped into this Gniza. There were materials that were taken with the family north that were taken to Aleppo. We'll talk about that later. But it seems that many things were left behind and ended up in this Gniza. So what I'd like to do with the few minutes that we have this afternoon is to look at different areas of Maimonides' life. For example, his communal affairs, him as a teacher, him as a halachic decisor, all through documents of the Cairo Gniza, using it to illuminate the type of life that he lived and the influence that he had. So we're going to begin with communal affairs. And we're looking here at a different document that is also signed by Maimonides. And here I'm making it a little bigger. You could see it's a little faded, but you can make out the name Moshe ben Ramaimon, and this is his typical signature that we see again and again. What is the contents of this letter? It goes as following. Here is a loose translation of the content here. It is estimated to have been written around the year 1170. Maimonides is writing to another Jewish community in Egypt, and he's saying as follows. Regarding the captives, act upon it in the same way as we, all the judges and elders of the students, have acted. Maimonides here is talking about a communal crisis that is facing the Jewish people in Egypt around the year 1170. And this is a time where Jews have been caught up in some sort of war, and they've been taken prisoner. And we know that at the time, there was actually skirmishes between the Egyptians' forces and the Crusaders who were in the land of Israel at the time. It seems that some Jews were caught up in this, were taken hostage, and the opposing side wanted to extract money from the Jewish community in order to free them. This is one of the ways they would finance their war. So Maimonides is writing to this community saying that you guys in your community, you need to do the same thing that we have been doing. What have we been doing? Going around day and night, urging people in the synagogues, the markets, and at the doors of the dwellings in order to collect something toward this great goal. Having contributed as much as we ourselves are able, you too should do for them as fits your generosity. And I want to highlight again that toward the beginning of this letter, it says that it wasn't lower people in the community, so to speak, who were doing this job. It was the judges and the elders and the students, the Talmid HaChamim, the people who were busy usually studying Talmud, closed their books and went out for the importance of this cause. Exert yourself to collect it quickly and send it to us with our above-mentioned dignitary, Reb Aaron Halevi. So Reb Aaron Halevi is the emissary being sent to this community in order to raise funds for this important cause. By the way, this particular letter is stored. It's owned by the JTS Library, the Library of the Jewish Theological Seminary, and right now it's on display. I'll talk about this maybe in a minute. But in Manhattan right now, there's something called the Golden Path, which is an exhibit about Maimonides, and it brings together many different manuscripts and printed editions that tell the story of Maimonides' life and influence throughout the ages. One of the pieces that they have on display is this actual document that you're looking at right now. Let's look at another sample from Maimonides' public work. And here is a note in his hand, does not have his signature, but again, once we have his handwriting, we're able to tell that this is no doubt his handwriting, where it says as follows: would the Sheikh Al-Watig, we assume this is referring to a Jewish person, and a prominent Jew at this time would be called a Sheikh, which just means a prominent person. So would the Sheikh, may God preserve him, enter town so that the meeting could be convened with him on Shabbat in the presence of the elders, and it will be decided what is to be done. May his welfare increase. Seems like there's some sort of emergency in the community, and there's going to be a meeting on Shabbat to deal with this important issue. We're going to see later on that for Maimonides, his week is packed. He does not have any spare time during the week. And when he's looking to schedule something, it's Shabbat is the time that he's designating for it. Now, you may be wondering, is it appropriate to use Shabbat for such matters? And the answer actually is yes. The Talmud rules that for communal issues, it is okay if it's important to convene a communal meeting on Shabbat to address an issue. And that's what seems to be the case over here. May his welfare increase. As for your note, it arrived too wet to be read. Okay, so this is an interesting small tidbit of information of, I'm sorry I couldn't read your message, but here's what I'm telling you, is you need to come to the meeting on Shabbos. And then if you look at the right-hand side, you'll see there's some vertical writing, and that's where Maimonides added, it is particularly important that you not come late. Greetings. So an interesting small window into the life of Maimonides as a communal leader. At the same time, he's also a halachic authority, which means he is fielding questions. And we have many examples of questions that are presented to Maimonides. Here he just needs to give an answer. He does not need to explain his rationale. He just needs to explain what the ruling is. So here is one of many examples. There is a note written in some hand, not Maimonides' hand, and it presents a question, and I'll summarize the question in a moment, but before I do, toward the bottom left, you may notice that in a different hand, there's some handwriting, and I'll make it a little bigger here, and that's where you see Maimonides' handwriting. This is his response in very few lines. You may be able to make out the last two words is Vikasav Moshe, and the spelling of the word Moshe here with the mem spilling into the shin, spilling into the hay, is the exact same way he formatted his name in the other documents that we saw. Here, instead of it being a full signature, Moshe Barabi Maimon, he's just writing Vikasav Moshe. Moshe has written. Indeed, very often when he's responding to halachic question, this is how he signs off at the end, and Moses has written Vikasav Moshe. What was the case here? Just so we get a little bit of a feel for what this is. So the case goes as follows. There's a father and a son, and they're both in the cloth business. Now, they're not really, it's not like they have one business under one, tax ID number. It's not entirely clear to people. Is this one business? Is this two businesses? Anyway, often what would happen is it's a father and son, so one would pick up merchandise in the morning, and the idea would be, yeah, my father's going to come later and he's going to pay. All right, makes sense to people, so people would give merchandise to one, and the other one would come later in the day to pay. Well, what happens is that one day the son took inventory of cloth, and the understanding was that the father was going to go and pay. The reality is that he disappears, he's left town, he's not here anymore. Okay, so they come to the father, and they say, pay up. Your son picked up cloth. Why don't you pay for it? He says, I'm responsible for everything my son does. He picked up cloth. It had nothing to do with me. I didn't send him. I didn't ask him. We anyway don't operate in the same business. Yeah, once in a while we help each other out, but I'm sorry. It's not one business. He's not here. You leave me alone. And so the person who gave the cloth is really disappointed. So maybe he has a talk with his lawyers, and they come up with the following idea. They come up with the following scheme. I want to put it to you that you, in fact, received money from your son to give to me. And if you want to say that that is not the case, I want you to swear to that effect. Now, the reason that's a strategic move is because Jews throughout the centuries tried avoiding swearing at all costs. So often, it would happen, you know something? I know I'm innocent, but I'd rather not take an oath. I want to be careful about how I utter God's name, especially as it relates to an oath. It's a very serious prohibition to take an oath that isn't 100% true. And so I'd rather pay the $100 and not have to deal with this mess at all. And that was just strategy here, where it was, I'm putting it to you that your son gave you money to deliver to me. Swear that that was not the case. And the question was, Do we force the father to swear in this case, or do we say, you don't have the right to, I'm not liable to take that oath. I shouldn't have to take that oath. Why should I take that oath? What evidence do you have to suggest that I indeed received that money, which would make me liable to take the oath? Anyway, so they presented this question to Maimonides, and in short, he answered in three short lines in Hebrew that indeed there was no grounds to force him to take an oath. What they could do is a cherem. A cherem is a public announcement that whoever owes money to so-and-so, whoever has money for the vendor who does not give him that money is hereby excommunicated. Without even naming the father as a suspect, that is okay, but anything in terms of forcing him to do an oath, not okay. This is the brief response that he gives. In these contexts, he does not explain his rationale. Usually, sometimes he does, but usually they're very, very brief, and there are many dozens of these. They have been published. And today, people, they go to the store and they buy the response of the Rambam. Many of them don't realize that what they're purchasing is newly discovered materials that have come out literally in the last few dozen years. Maimonides is most famous, however, as an author. And he has written numerous works, and we'll touch upon some of them right now, not all of them. One of his earlier works is the Commentary to the Mishnah. He's the first one to write a thorough, complete, comprehensive commentary on the entire Mishnah from the beginning to the end is Maimonides. And he writes this in Judeo-Arabic. That's important. Some of his works, or specifically the Mishnah Torah, which we'll talk about later, was written in Hebrew. But this is written for the audience of Jews who, for them, Judeo-Arabic is their language. And many medieval Jewish works were written in this language. It's using the Aleph Beis. It's a lot of Arabic. It's a lot of Jewish words mixed in as well, similar to the way Yiddish is the Hebrew alphabet, a lot of German and a lot of Hebrew words mixed in together. In the Gniza, the following pages were found, and when scholars look at this closely, what they're able to see is that this is none other than an early draft of his commentary to the Mishnah. So we have the commentary to the Mishnah the way it appears today. There are some differences between this and what we have, and therefore the assumption is that this was an earlier draft of this commentary to the Mishnah. Now, when we're speaking about the commentary to the Mishnah, I do want to jump away a little bit from the Cairo Gniza and share the other part of the story. I mentioned before about the descendants of Maimonides making the trek north, going to Aleppo and residing there. And I said some of the stuff they left behind in Cairo and it ends up in the Gniza. But some of the material they did take themselves. And that relates a little bit to the commentary of the Mishnah, which I want to talk about now for a moment. In England, during the 17th century, there was a renowned scholar by the name of Edward Pocock. And Pocock today has a collection in the Bodleian Library that's named for him. And he was a Hebraist, which means he was interested in studying different elements of Judaism. And he, in fact, published in this regard works of Maimonides. His work here, the title page on the right-hand side, is called Porta Moses. Porta Moses means the gates of Moses. Maimonides, in his life, wrote numerous introductions that are of great import. An introduction to the Mishnah. An introduction to Pirkei Avot. It's called the 8 chapters. An introduction to the Mishnah Torah. And numerous other works of introduction that are really important to understand the background of rabbinic law. And Pocock thought this was important for the world, the Christian world, to see. And so what he did is he published it, Hebrew alongside a Latin translation that he did. This work was published in 1655. Anyway, and you see his interest in Maimonides, and it's with against that background that we understand. He finds himself in Aleppo. One of the things he's doing there, he's searching out Jewish manuscripts, and he's purchasing them, and he amassed a very significant collection, which ended up in the Bodleian Library in Oxford. One of the things when he was in Aleppo is he somehow purchased a copy of Maimonides' master copy of the Mishnah. That's where the following page comes from, which may be familiar to some of you because of the image of the menorah. There's this idea that the Rambam, in his own handwriting, wrote out what the menorah would have designed, what the menorah would have looked like. And there are a few notable things about this image. Number one, the cups, so to speak, that are on the arms of the menorah are upside down, and that's been noted by many. And secondly, the branches, rather than being semicircular, are straight, are on a diagonal. And much has been written about that subject, and that's not important for us right now. What I do want to highlight is this is where the image comes from. It comes from this particular manuscript, which the assumption is, there is a little bit of a debate about it, but the assumption is that this page, the entire commentary of the Mishnah that you see in front of you, is written in Maimonides' own hand. Everyone agrees that it's extremely similar. There's some academic quibbling about whether the actual writing is his writing, but even if it's not, the writing on the side that you see on the left-hand side, the additions, everyone agrees is Maimonides' writing. At the very least, we're talking about Maimonides' master copy, if not the one that he autographed by him on his own. And I should say that many great scholars, such as Rabbi Yosef Kapach in Israel, an important Yemenite scholar who was a great expert in Maimonides, he and many others said that this entire work is all in Maimonides' hand. So this would be the final work. And this did make its way from Egypt to Syria. It was the earlier drafts that I showed you a moment ago that end up in the Cairo Geniza. So much in terms of this is in terms of the commentary to the Mishnah. Now, I want to talk now about the unrealized work. And the unrealized work is, we have a passage from Maimonides in one of his responsa where he writes that he doesn't have the time to do what he wanted to do for the Jerusalem Talmud, to do similar to what Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi had done before him for the Babylonian Talmud. So let me take a minute to explain what this line means. The Talmud is exceedingly difficult. It's doable, but it's hard. And during the 10th century, the 11th century, there was a sage by the name of Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi who lived in Spain. And he wrote a digest of the Talmud, which means he removed a lot of the back and forth and a lot of the complex discussions. It was focused on getting to the bottom line of each piece. And this became very popular at the time, and many people studied it. And he only did that, however, for the Babylonian Talmud. It seems that Maimonides is writing here, he had a plan to do part two. Part two is to go to the Jerusalem Talmud, because we have two Talmuds, go to the Jerusalem Talmud and do the same thing. Remove some of what would be deemed to be the excess material, write a new work that focuses on the bottom line. And here we have Maimonides writing that he didn't have the time to realize this dream. And scholars have always known about this idea, but what exactly was this work that he was saying he intended to do? But then the following pages were discovered in the Cairo Geniza. And when they were studied closely, it looks like the Jerusalem Talmud, but it's Maimonides' hand. And why would Maimonides be copying the Jerusalem Talmud? And it's very clear this is a truncated version of the Jerusalem Talmud. This is not the full version. And so what immediately became clear is that we're dealing here with that work that Maimonides said he didn't have the time to do. And he had this idea of doing this particular work of truncating and writing a simplified version of the Jerusalem Talmud. And that allows us actually to theorize a little bit about what may have happened. And obviously, this is just an hypothesis, so we shouldn't get too carried away with it. But you could imagine something going along the following lines. Maimonides has just finished writing his commentary to the Mishnah. He's like, great, I took a primary text of Judaism, the Mishnah, and I made it accessible to all speakers of Judeo-Arabic. Great, what's next? What's my next book that I'm going to be writing? Well, I should make the Babylonian Talmud easier. Well, I don't need to do that. Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi already made the Babylonian Talmud easier. I don't need to do that. Oh, so what's next? Oh, the Jerusalem Talmud. No one has made that accessible. I'll go and do that. And so you kind of can imagine that this is what leads Maimonides to say this is what he's going to do. But then he gets this grand idea of why create a digest just for the Jerusalem Talmud? How about if you do the Mishnah Torah? What's the Mishnah Torah? The Mishnah Torah summarizes the entire Babylonian Talmud, the entire Jerusalem Talmud, and numerous other halachic works of Midrash, bringing it all together in one systematic and organized text. That's a gigantic idea, and you can imagine that as it dawned upon Maimonides, the enormity of this idea, the Mishnah Torah, suddenly the idea of just making the Jerusalem Talmud accessible felt a little less important, and that would have led Maimonides to go ahead and abandon that work, which is essentially what happened. Here I'm making it a little bigger. You may be able to make out on the top, it says Brachot, because indeed this is his work on Brachot. On top of that, you may be able to notice on the top line, it says B'Shem Hashem Kel Olam. If you're familiar with Maimonides' works, every book begins with that line, B'Shem Hashem Kel Olam. Now, This has been published a long time ago. In 1948, there was a scholar by the name of Saul Lieberman. He was the Rosh Yeshiva, or the leader of the Talmudic side of things in the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, and an enormous Talmud Chacham, a very wise man. And he took this manuscript and he published it. And that's why you see the title page over there, Hilchas HaYerushalmi L'Rabbeinu Moshe Ben Maimon Me'etzem K'sav Yad Kodosh Kotshoy. This is his work that he produced. Now, if you go back to the previous image, you'll notice that there are gaps. The text is incomplete. So what would Saul Lieberman do when he reached the end of the line where the page cuts out? So one is just leave it blank. But he didn't have to, because number one, he was very intelligent. Number two, he knows what Maimonides is trying to do. This is the Jerusalem Talmud, which we have. Maimonides has a method of shortening. So once you understand his method, you can kind of guess what he would have done in those lines, especially because you're able to see how much space and what's going on in the lines below it. So he did. He guessed. He guessed what Maimonides would have written in those lines. He obviously set it off in a different font. About 10 years ago, there was someone going through a document to the Cairo Gniza and found the following little fragment, which matches perfectly. Don't be bothered by the different color. That just has to do with the lighting that the image is exposed to. This is one page, by the way. So you're looking at the right-hand side and left-hand side are just the flip side of the same page. This is the match of the missing material. And lo and behold, it's pretty much exactly what Lieberman had guessed Maimonides would have been, which really shows the enormity of his intellect. Anyway. Now we're going to talk about the Mishneh Torah. The Mishneh Torah is, for us, it's Maimonides' magnum opus. There are many of us who study it every day. And indeed, the Cairo Gniza has been a gold mine in terms of having a much better understanding of the Mishneh Torah. And that's because of the following type of document. There are about 20 pages in the Gniza that are this. We look at it, we know two things. This is unmistakably Maimonides' handwriting. It's unmistakably the Mishneh Torah. We also know it's unmistakably not the same version that we have with us today. There are changes. We're also able to see how the man is at work. He is writing, he is crossing out, he is inserting information between the lines. Here is a typed out version that I worked on to kind of give you a little bit of a feel for what's happening here. This is the laws of when you hire an employee to work in the field. That employee needs to be given permission to eat from the produce while they're working. And as I mentioned before, this is, you can see the great mind at work in terms of producing. And if you really want to have fun, you can say, what didn't he like about the version that he crossed out? And that could be a whole new field of study to try to figure out what was he negating, why is he not happy with the earlier version and chose to cross it out. Here is a comparison between the text the way we have it today in our Mishneh Torah versus the way it appeared on that document you saw before. The most important difference that's obvious is that you'll notice on the top right, it says Perek Tishii, which means it is the 9th chapter. And on the left-hand side, it says Perek Shneim Asar. This is the 12th chapter. So this is a small example of the type of difference that even as we're seeing Maimonides updating that document that we saw before, but that is not the final version. That is a precursor to the final version, not the final version itself. As I said before, there are about 20 or so of those pages, and in fact, this one I find quite interesting. The ink isn't dark enough to be able to get a full feel for what's going on, but again, I typed it out on the left-hand side, and I'm going to read with you the text on the left-hand side. It says, Sefer Achad Asar, the 11th book, Vahu Sefer Mishpatim, and that is the book that is called Mishpatim. Indeed, Maimonides, the Mishneh Torah, has one of the books. It's called Sefer Mishpatim, which means laws. Hilchosav Arba Esrei, and it's going to have 14 sections, Vizehu Sidron, and this is what they are going to be. And then it goes on to say that the first section is Hilchas Niske Mamain, and that is when you have property that, for example, an animal that goes into someone else's property and causes damage, what is the law? There are four positive commandments. This is what they are. And then toward the bottom of the page, he starts writing out the text. And here again, there's writing, there's crossing out it's pretty close to the version of Mishneh Torah the way we have it, with some minor differences. But what's most important to realize here is Mishneh Torah has 14 books. 14 books. Book number 13 is Mishpatim. Book number 14 is Shoftim, Judges. Book number book number 13 is Mishpatim. This here has Mishpatim as book 11. Book 11. So in other words, what happened over here? Book 11 for us is Nizikin. Book 12 is Kinyan. Book 13 is Mishpatim. Maimonides had initially intended all three of those books would be under one big book called Mishpatim. And indeed, there are all, you know, can not neatly fit under the category of Mishpatim, of laws. And then Mishnah Torah would have been 12 books. And at this stage in writing, the Geniza stage in writing, indeed, Mishnah Torah would have been 12 books. Same amount of chapters, but 12 books. At a later point, not entirely clear why, he decided, you know what, let's divide that into three, Nizikin, Kinyan, and Mishpatim. And indeed, Nizikin is a very small book, perhaps even the smallest book of the Mishnah Torah. I don't remember right now. And that's similar to what happened in the Talmud. There was once a time that the three Babas were one tractate. Baba Kama, Baba Metziah, Baba Basra, talking about the same issues. There was once a time this was a 30-chapter tractate that was called Tractate Nizikin. And then, because of how long it was divided into three, which is how we got the names Baba Kama, Baba Metziah, and Baba Basra. On Baba Basra, a quick note, during the Bayless trial, the famous case where there was a blood libel in the early 20th century and early part of the 20th century in Russia, I remember reading in a memoir where I think his name was Katz. He said that he was at the trial, and they brought up an expert who was going to say that that Jews indeed need to kill a Christian child in order to extract blood for the Passover service. And they found some professor from like the eastern section of Russia who said he's been studying Judaism all his life. He knows everything about Judaism and the Talmud, and he's ready to testify about the veracity of this claim. This was a state witness. So Katz said that he spoke to the lawyer. He was sitting, he was a journalist. He said, this guy, I heard him talk. He doesn't know anything about Judaism. So you need to, when he gets on the stand, you need to expose how he doesn't really know anything. So this is what you should do. You should ask him, when did Baba Basra live? Now, the reason that's important is because Baba in Russian means like, you know, a grandmother. So So ask, when did Baba Basra live? So they weren't sure, because what if he knows the answer, then it can kind of backfire. So they were thinking about it. They decided to ask a soft question. First, they said, what does Tractate Chulin talk about? He said, oh, I don't know. And then they realized, if he doesn't know what Tractate Chulin talks about, good chance. So they asked him, when did Baba Basra live? So he said, I'm not sure when Baba Basra lived. And then the whole courtroom burst out. Many people knew what this was, burst out in laughter, and that kind of discredited the witness. Anyway, that's an aside about Baba Basra. So we had those three tractates being merged into one, and here we have Maimonides' Mishnah Torah as well, three being merged into one. This is in terms of the earlier drafts of the Rambam's Mishnah Torah. What about Maimonides' master text, his Mishnah Torah? If you would have come to him the year he passed away in 1204 and said, where is your copy, the primary copy of Mishnah Torah? As far as we know today, we don't have it. We don't have that master copy. We assume that it would have gone with the family to Aleppo, but it doesn't exist as far as we can tell. But what we do have is the closest thing to that. And that is the first progeny of Maimonides' Mishnah Torah we have. So let me show that to you. This is not a Geniza fragment. This comes from the archive that was in Aleppo. This brings us to another non-Jew in the same century, in the 17th century. His name was Robert Huntington. He also went to Syria to collect Judaic manuscripts. He was also an Hebraist. His materials today are as well at the Bodleian Library in Oxford. And he came back with the following book. Now, the reason this book is so important is because this is a Mishnah Torah. It is the conclusion of the second book, which is Sefer Ava. Now, before I talk a little more about it, I'm just saying personally, this is actually really meaningful. There is a cycle of studying Rambam, which is an amazing opportunity, and it's a real gift to be able to do this every day. There's one cycle that does three chapters a day. There's another cycle that does one chapter a day, and then there is a cycle that does the Sefer HaMitzvot. For the cycle that is doing one chapter a day, today is the Siyum, the conclusion of the second book, the book of Ava. You're looking right now at the conclusion of the second book, the book of Sefer Ava. The laws of circumcision are presented here on the page. And then you have the wrap-up that on the left-hand side saying the different sections and how many halachot were in each section. And this is not written in Maimonides' hand. If you may be able to tell, if you're looking, this is a professional scribe. The margins are very even, and the handwriting is beautiful, and you wouldn't have any trouble reading it. So this is not Maimonides' handwriting. But what we do have is on the bottom left, on the left-hand page, we have an added line that was that still talks to us today. And let's make it a little bigger so we can have a look. What does it say? It says, Huga Misifri, edited against my copy, Ani, I am, Moshe, Berabi Maimon, and the same acronym that you have at the end that we saw earlier. And in fact, the signature is the exact same signature that we see in the Gniza materials. Edited against my copy, I am, Moshe, Berabi Maimon. So let me explain one scenario of how all of this went down and what is the significance of this manuscript that you're looking at right now. Let's say I decide I want to have Maimonides. I want to have his Mishnah Torah at home. What do I need to do? I can't go and buy a printed set. This is centuries before the printing press. I need to go to a scribe. So I go to Yankel, the scribe, and I say, Yankel, do me a favor. You're going to write for me a Mishnah Torah. So he says, sure, you'll come back in 6 months, 8 months, a year. It takes a long time to write, just like it takes a long time to write a Sefer Torah. It's the same thing. It's a manuscript by hand. I come back after 8 months and I say, thank you very much for the Mishnah Torah, the manuscript. Here's the payment that I'm giving to you. There's another thing I need to do before I can take it home and feel comfortable that I have a good text. And this was standard across the world in the manuscript age. I need to take it to an editor. And the reason is because every scribe makes mistakes. It happens all the time, especially scribes that work quicker and they were a little sloppier, but even the professional scribes, they make errors. And so you built in this second stage where you go to a copy editor who, I'm not entirely clear how they worked. They may have checked areas that they knew to kind of be problematic, for example, especially if the field, like they know their field, like, oh yeah, that's an area where a lot of people make mistakes. Or generally, they'll do spot checking, and then that was a normal way of getting comfortable with the work that you had. Now, you could just go to any reliable text, and you could edit it against that as long as you know that your text is reliable. It seems that in this case, this person, the patron, the one who commissioned this manuscript, comes none other to Maimonides, who's alive, and says, I need to spot check this book. Why not against your master copy? And Maimonides says, sure, come in. He sits him down at the dining room table, brings out his master copy, and then the guy gets to work. Either he or someone else, they start comparing and editing the Mishnah Torah against Rambam's master copy. Indeed, through this manuscript, and I point out this entire manuscript can be read online, it's also currently, for the next 2 or 3 weeks, it's at the same exhibit that I mentioned before. So if you want to see this, as well as the menorah, image that I showed earlier, it's those two manuscripts will be at this exhibit, I think, till mid-September. But anyway, where was I? So at the end of this work, he now turns to Maimonides and says, thank you so much for allowing me to fact check and to proof my manuscript against your master copy. Could you now sign off on it? And that's what happened here. Maimonides signed off and said, Huga Misifri, it has been edited against my copy, Ani Moshe Berabi Maimon. And indeed, if you go through this manuscript, there are many corrections that were made. So we can actually see this work in process and where words are crossed out and words added in. There is a significant debate that we don't have to resolve today, and that is, how authoritative is this text? And I'll just give you two ways of thinking about it. One would be, this has Maimonides' signature, and he said that this volume was corrected against his text. What can be better than that? Whatever it says in here, this is the official canonized version of Maimonides' Mishnah Torah, and there are conflicting readings, and so we should go with this. Not everyone agrees with that. The alternative is, well, is Maimonides attesting that this guy actually did a perfect job in correcting everything? Did he? Who says? Furthermore, what is the nature of this work of Haggah, of editing? Do you literally go word for word, letter for letter, or do you spot check? And so therefore, it's kind of an open question what to do when there's a conflict between this manuscript and another. I hasten to add that these conflicts are usually not all that meaningful in terms of a practical difference in Jewish law, but we do want to get the text right, and that is an ongoing field of study today for people who are studying trying to determine what is the perfect text of Maimonides' Mishnah Torah. This is only Mada and Ava, the first two works of Maimonides' Mishneh Torah. What about the rest? The rest are gone. We don't have this. We don't have this. I called it before, the first progeny. I said, we don't have the master text. We have the closest thing. The closest thing, a reflection of the master text, is this. The reflection is only here for Mada and Ava. We don't have it for the rest of the books. It's not entirely clear what happened, but we know for sure they once existed. How do we know they once existed? First of all, on the very first page of this volume, it says, I'm here for the whole Mishneh Torah. So we know that it existed for the whole thing. But we also know it for the following reason. You're looking here at a 14th century manuscript. It is a different book of Maimonides on the section called Avodah. And there has a colophon at the end of the book. A colophon is where the scribe tells you a little bit about himself and what he did. And without reading all the words here, essentially what it says is, I'm the scribe whose name is Nassan Halevi, writing in, again, the first quarter of the 14th century. And I wrote and edited this version of the Mishneh Torah against the copy, and in that copy it says that it was Hugam Isifri, it was edited against Maimonides' master copy. So here we have echoes of the same idea that we had for Mada and Ava, once existed for the work of Avodah, which talks about the laws of the Beis HaMikdash and the Holy Temple. But that work that was the actual physical copy that was used against Maimonides' copy has vanished, but that itself was copied. And each one took pride in that their manuscript was a reflection of a manuscript that itself was a reflection of, and so therefore they attested to that. And that's how we have the echoes of the full set, so to speak, of this Mishneh Torah that we saw before. That's in terms of the Mishneh Torah. After the Rambam finished Mishneh Torah, he wrote the Guide to the Perplexed. This is a philosophical work. Unlike the Mishneh Torah, he wrote this in Judeo-Arabic. And in the Gniza, the following documents were found. These are early drafts of the first section of the Mora Nevuchim, or the Guide to the Perplexed. It is volume 1. These correspond to chapters 64 and 65. Now, I want to talk for a moment about Rambam as a philosopher, because that brings me to the following document, which is one of my favorites. You have here a letter that there's an unnamed individual who's writing a note to Maimonides. And he says as follows, I read the Guide to the Perplexed. I did my homework. I'm still left with many philosophical questions. I would like to meet you to discuss it with you. It's written on a rotulus. That's this particular formation of the parchment. And this is what the person writes. He wants to have an audience with the Rambam to discuss his philosophical questions. So he wrote his note on one side, and the Rambam issued his response on the same piece of parchment, but on the verso, on the other side. Before we get to the response, obviously in this type of letter, there's blessings, there's honorifics, you're writing to the greatest Jewish sage. And so amongst the blessings, I found an interesting line that I thought was interesting, where it says as follows, Hakel Yarech Yamav Ushnoisav Bani Imi, may God lengthen your days and they should be pleasant. V'yechaye Eloi HaPerach HaNoim, and may he enliven for you, keep alive for you your pleasant flower. V'yishmareyu Mikol Ra, and protect him from all evil. V'yigadloi B'chachmo V'yira, raise him in wisdom and reverence. V'yekuyam Alav, and it should be for him the verse, Tachas Avoisecha. This is a reference to a verse that says the child will take over the father as the monarch. What's happening here? We have in here a reference to Reb Avram, the son and the only child of Maimonides. The person writing to Maimonides is giving him, showering him with blessings, and one of the things he calls him, HaPerach HaNoim, the pleasant flower, and blessing that he should take over his father one day. That's the blessing that he's giving Maimonides. Well, guess what? That is exactly what happened. After Maimonides passed away, Avram, his son, took over the leadership of the community at the time. He also wrote books, a commentary on the Torah, for example, which was completely forgot to history were it not for the Cairo Gniza, and that's how we discovered his commentary on Genesis and Exodus. And so therefore, if you ever hear a piece of commentary from Reb Avram, the son of the Rambam, on the Torah, it is thanks to the fact that we have this wonderful archive. Anyway, I said that Maimonides issued a response. Let's read the response. The response goes as follows. Here it's a little worn out, but in summary it says as follows. You surely have seen and heard about the extent to which I am under the yoke of non-Jews. At this point in his life, Maimonides becomes a physician. And every day he needs to travel to the Sultan's palace, and he has to deal with the Sultan and many of the ministers as well. I am broken to pieces from morning to evening. I return at night feeling sick and in pain. I can't sit due to extensive fatigue, so I'm forced to lay on my back. What's interesting, we have other letters of the Rambam where he writes the same thing. Come to the Beit Midrash each Shabbat, and then you will inevitably gain a little of what you wish to get from me. I mentioned earlier how Shabbat was Rambam's free time. That's what you see. I cannot meet you in the weekday to discuss philosophical questions. Perhaps God will provide some free time for study and for teaching. This is his response, and it really goes back to what we spoke about with how we opened about his communal leadership, which really didn't leave a lot of time for the other things, and that only underscores more how grateful we need to be that he wrote the commentary to the Mishnah, that he wrote the Mora Nevuchim, that he wrote the Mishnah Torah and put all that work into it. Now, I want to show you something really interesting. This is Maimonides' response in his own handwriting. I'm now zooming in on the third line. I'm going to put an arrow. What are we looking at? A fingerprint. Whose fingerprint is that? Who had access to the document when the ink was wet? Maimonides. We have here, presumably, Maimonides' fingerprint, which is an amazing thing. We do not have we don't have a picture of Maimonides. We don't assume that the image that is widely associated with him is actually the way he looked. But that's pretty, besides for his autograph, now we have his fingerprint. That is absolutely amazing. Let's now move along to his role as a physician. In the following fragment from the Gniza, we have here an entire concoction that Maimonides suggests someone take in order to help that person do what we call the first mitzvah in the Torah, in order to build a family. And along the way, the Rambam writes over here that wine is necessary, and then he adds, or honey for one who does not consider wine permissible. The assumption here is that Maimonides was writing this for a non-Jew, a Muslim, for whom wine was not an option. And so treating them, we alluded to this earlier, helping them do what they needed to do, and giving them a substitute instead of wine, letting it be honey. I believe that Rabbi Dr. Eddie Reichman, in his he has a presentation on the Rambam, and he was the one who called my attention to this wonderful document. Now, we need to start thinking about the close. So I want to kind of address, and with this we'll conclude, how did Rambam become a physician? Why did he become a physician? As far as we can tell, earlier in his life, he wasn't a physician. So the theory goes as follows. It's long been known, because this letter has come down to us through the ages, not a Gniza letter, that the Rambam had faced a terrible tragedy in his life. And here he's writing about it in a letter. In summary, he's describing how he had a brother, whose name was David, who drowned in the Indian Sea. He calls it Yam Hodu, the Indian Sea. And he says that once that accident occurred, he's never been the same. Rambam talks about him struggling with the negative emotions associated with a traumatic loss. And he says that he used to support me. He used to take care of me and my needs, and now I need to find a way to do that, not only for my own family, but for his family as well, because he had left a wife and a daughter, if I recall correctly. And if you go line after line, you read this letter, very poignant, very touching, very sad, the way the Rambam discusses this. So the thinking is, we know that Maimonides had a very strict view about rabbis taking a salary, which we can't get into right now. But in summary, he did not believe that it was appropriate, and almost everyone disagreed with him, but this was his view. He did not believe that rabbis had the right to earn money for teaching Torah. So as a result, what he did earlier in life is he had an initial investment that he gave to his brother. His brother would travel, do business, and this is how both families were supported. Once his brother had passed away, now the obligation fell on him to become the bread earner, both for both families. he's of the view that you can't take money for teaching Torah, which is what he was doing most of his time. And so the theory is that's why he turns to medicine. Now here, I want to show you a map just to understand the historical context of the what's happening here with the Indian Sea. For Jews living in Egypt, most of before we come to the Crusader era, the easiest place to trade was in the Mediterranean Sea, which is on the left-hand side of the screen. Once the Crusaders came and they put in blockades in the Mediterranean, not allowing people from Islamic countries to engage in trade, this forced Jews and others in Cairo to instead go south, take the Red Sea south, and then cross the Arabian Sea, and then go do business in India. And it seems that this is the context of why Reb David, the brother of the Rambam, perished. Now, all of that is background for an amazing document from the Gniza. Highly damaged, but an amazing document nonetheless. What do we have here? Well, let's read. To my beloved brother, Reb Moshe ben Maimon, I arrived in Adahab and found no imports had come here. So I thought about what I had endured in the desert and how I was saved. Then it appeared to me an easy matter to embark on a sea voyage. I am doing all this out of my continuous efforts for your material well-being, although you have never imposed on me anything of the kind. What do we have here? We have Reb David writing a letter during his travels, and he alludes to something that I took out for brevity, and I'll elaborate a little more. He writes this long story of how he missed his caravan, and he chose, nonetheless, despite the dangers, to kind of travel through a dangerous desert, which is what he did. Now that he survived that, he kind of felt pretty good about himself and his fortune. And so he said, you know something? If I did that, I can do the more aggressive thing of crossing the Indian Ocean, which he says here that he's doing for his brother. And the historical context that I gave you before would help explain that. And so the bottom line is, it seems, it is a very good guess, that this may be the last letter that Reb David wrote to his brother Reb Moshe before that terrible journey that he took, from which he never returned. And this is kind of that missing piece. We have the letter from Rambam writing about the death of his brother. This seems to be the last regards that he would have received from his brother, which is what forced him into the role of a physician. So in summary, what did we do today? We saw that the Cairo Gniza is an amazing resource for understanding the life and times of the Rambam, both as communal leader, as a scholar, as a halachic authority, as a commentator, as a codifier, and all these things. This is just a small drop in a vast bucket. And the opportunity is there for us, we are interested in learning about the Rambam, to kind of deepen our appreciation by looking further into this subject matter. And of course, always come back to the idea of the study of Mishnah Torah, which is so crucially important. And I'll conclude with the following brief remarks. The Lubavitcher Rebbe in 1951 wrote the following letter, and it really picks up on what we spoke about before in terms of the tragedy of Maimonides. The Rebbe wrote as follows: we see very clearly that to a major extent, the events that happen in life, the degree that they have an effect on you emotionally, depends on how you receive it, how you interact with it. What's the evidence for this? He says he chose, interestingly, to bring Maimonides as an example. Why? Because if we look at Maimonides' life, and I assume the Rebbe is referring to the different letters that kind of describe his life story. You're talking about someone who grows up, has to flee Spain because of Amha, something that we didn't discuss today, and then has to travel to the land of Israel, and then has to come down to Egypt. And then in Egypt, we saw him saying how his day is, he's literally overloaded with problems. And then the loss of his brother. So you're dealing with someone who didn't have an easy life. And nonetheless, we're able to see that his world's view, as it is explained in the Guide to the Perplexed, was very positive. And here the Rebbe used the English word optimistic. What the Rebbe is referring to the fact that in the first section of Mora Nevuchim, there's a long philosophical discussion about how should we look at this world. Should we look at it as a place that's a bad place where some good things happen, or the contrary, should we look at it as a good place where there's some negative things that happen. And Maimonides quotes a philosopher who lived before him, who says that this world, if you look at it from a pure philosophical perspective, you understand that this world is really a rotten, horrible place. And Maimonides goes chapter after chapter after chapter, arguing and disagreeing with rational arguments, not based on faith, maybe informed by faith, but using rational arguments to explain that in fact this is not true. A very fascinating section in the Mor Nevuchim. And the Rebbe noticed that. And the Rebbe said, look, if there's anyone who had an excuse to kind of have a tinged perspective on reality, it would have been Maimonides. He easily could have said, well, look at all these things that happened to me, and then you use your experience to kind of impose that on the world, and that becomes the way to look at life. And nonetheless, when it came to writing his guide, he insisted that that not be the case. That shows us that there's separation between life events and the emotional reaction that a person has, and that's the space where the human being makes a choice. On the other hand, the Rebbe says, we see many people who are doing quite well in life, but for whatever reason, only once in a while do we find any degree of satisfaction in them. So if we're looking for a practical lesson to take away from Maimonides, in addition to all the learning and academic stuff we can do, there's also that idea of recognizing that our reaction, our emotional lives are essentially choices that we get to make. And Maimonides made that choice in his day in the 12th century, and we can make that choice today. Thank you very much.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.